Welcome to the ISF podcast from the Information Security Forum, featuring cutting-edge conversations tailored to global security professionals. I'm your host, Tavia Gilbert. In today's episode, we consider information security from the perspective of a member of Generation Z, the first totally native digital generation, and we'll contrast her thoughts about cyber with those of a veteran security leader. Why compare these two generations' experiences and attitudes? Because Gen Z, now entering the workforce, has such a different mindset toward cybersecurity than preceding generations did. We first touched on the Gen Z perspective in our Season 1 Emerging Threats episode, and we'll link that episode in the show notes. But the ISF continues to explore the opportunities and the challenges of this young generation's emerging professional presence. We'll start with Steve in conversation with Gen Zer Mahak Vora, CEO of Skillbank, formerly on Delta. Skillbank is a 15-week-long marketing training program that makes valuable hands-on experience affordably available through a unique business model tailored to the needs of Gen Z. And then we'll return to an interview with a friend to ISF, Rich Guida, former VP of Information Security at Johnson & Johnson, and now managing director at the security consulting firm Guida Technology Associates, Inc. Longtime listeners to this podcast may remember that Rich was our first guest interview, and it's no surprise that threats he touched on in that interview, including the security of the grid, are as relevant today as they were in 2018. We'll start with Steve's conversation with Mahak Vora.
I think it'd be really helpful if you could just give me an overview of how you came to be CEO of a number of different startups and really engage in this whole social media, disruptive education, a whole range of different really interesting things. So how did that all come about?
Yeah. So my startup journey started while I was in college. I was studying computer science at Purdue University. And going into my freshman year, I knew that I didn't want to go work at a big tech company. I wanted to use the skills that I was learning to build something of my own. And after my freshman year, my friend invited me to San Francisco for a conference for college dropouts that were looking to start companies. And when I showed up at this conference, there were 400 people there who hadn't gone to college and were building companies and had gotten funding. And this just completely blew my mind because I'm from a small town in West Virginia. And to me, I always thought that, you know, you have to go to college, you have to get a degree, you have to go work somewhere, you have to get experience, and then you can start something. So to see people that were just jumping like feet in, no experience maybe beforehand, was a really wild concept to me. But that weekend just completely changed my life. And when I came back from San Francisco, I set myself on a mission to convince my parents into letting me drop out. Mm-hmm. And a year later, I finally got them to accept it after a lot of conversations. They gave me 6 months and they were just like, all right, if you can figure things out in San Francisco for the next 6 months and become financially independent, we'll let you do it. So one of the ways that I convinced them was by starting an advertising agency at Purdue, where we just worked with a lot of the startups that were there.
As it turns out, Mahak didn't fail. She thrived, creating a successful startup around LinkedIn marketing before moving on to start on Delta, the education company she currently runs, rechristened Skillbank.
You said you'd walked into this environment, 400 people, hadn't been to college, or looking at starting up businesses and what have you. Obviously, the industry that I'm in, the cyber business, information security and risk management, you know, we're suffering from a skill shortage. We simply can't find enough people who want to work in that space. And there was a little bit of an alarm bell that went off for me when you were saying that, because I was thinking, well, you know, the great sort of hope for a lot of organizations is, well, we can target Gen Z, new millennials, they'll come in, they'll, you know, and that kind of thing. But from what you're saying, particularly for a large organization, perhaps that isn't as attractive to your generation. Would that be fair?
I think it is. Really, what it comes down to is how the training's happening and how are we actually placing them in a role at these companies. When Gen Z looks at education, they don't want to waste their time unless they're like trying to explore and they're trying to find new things. And when I was looking at building on Delta in the beginning, what we were originally looking for is, what are these markets? I think security is actually a great market that eventually someday I'd love to go into. But what are these markets that you don't actually really need a college degree for, but you need to study for that specific field? And how can you learn those skills very quickly and then go and land a job? And I think Gen Z is, their wheels are starting to turn in their head when they're thinking about, hey, maybe I don't need to go spend $40,000 a year on a college degree. Maybe instead I can go to an online bootcamp. I can learn those skills very quickly and I can start earning by the time I'm 19 or 20 years old and just build up experience over the span of the next 3 to 4 years. And we're trying to capitalize on that movement, but I think that college is also going to become a lot less important. People are going to look at university as being something that you really only go to unless you're needing higher education, like needing to become a doctor or a lawyer or a teacher or something that needs education.
I wanted to ask you whether or not you had any tips for people who might be listening to this, who are, you know, Generation Z, who might be thinking of starting their own business or are just intrigued by some of the things we've been talking about here.
Absolutely. If you're looking to start a business or start your own company, the best place to start is just by having conversations, talking to people that are already in the space. How are they looking at building their companies? How are they looking at the space, the trends? Where is it all going? I mean, OnDelta wasn't just started as something that happened overnight. It was months and months of conversations with people that were in the space. And then the most important thing you can do after that is really just start. I mean, you can't do too much preparation. And it's funny because I just said to have conversations first, but as you're educating yourself within the space, the best way to really learn is to just put yourself out there and start doing things. I think a lot of people think that you have to be well-educated, you have to have a degree, you have to have had previous work experience to do X, Y, and Z, but I think a lot of people forget that they can create their own experience by just getting out there and doing something. And if everything doesn't work out, let's say your company fails, things don't go in the direction that you expected it to. If you put yourself out there, you tried new things, and you used that experience of starting that business as being a way for you to learn something new, you can take that experience with you when you're going to find your next job and say, hey, I learned this, this, and this while trying to start my own thing. And I know that for you, I can do X, Y, and Z because of what I learned. So as long as you think of everything as being a new learning experience that you can use, it's really hard to actually fail at something.
So fantastic advice. At the ISF, we produce a report called The Threat Horizon. And in our one that looks out to 2 years, Threat Horizon 2022, we talk specifically about Gen Z and about some of the challenges of providing security to that demographic, mainly because you may have seen, you know, Microsoft produced a survey that looked at the fact that, you know, Gen Z use the same password for a number of different accounts that they have that perhaps is not best practice. Obviously, Gen Z have grown up sharing information on a much, much broader scale than, say, boomers in particular, or Y or X. And so there's a whole range of different issues that organizations are going to have to come to terms with as millennials, Gen Z in particular, move into the workplace. The reason I keep hammering the security piece is that kind of enthusiasm that I think that the security industry could really take advantage of and benefit from. You know, one of the challenges I think that everybody faces is that security is no longer restricted to large-scale business. You know, it affects every single one of us because everything that we do that is connected in some way has the potential for a security breach and access into our own information. And clearly, one of the big challenges is around that whole sort of awareness piece. So I'm interested in any of your thoughts around that.
Yeah, I think because of the internet, we have a lot of access to more information. And I think because of that, it's made us a little bit more trusting with how information is shared with us, what information is going out from our phones. We all understand the trade-off between using a social media platform for free and them using our data to sell to advertisers. Like, that's nothing new to, I think, the Gen Z market, because we grew up with Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok, Facebook. I think really what needs to happen over the span of the next few years is we're starting to see a little bit of a shift now towards more private groups, where people are now, instead of using Instagram as a way to reach a bunch of people, they're using it as a way to reach their small friends. And I think it's starting this trend towards, I think, actually moving back from trying to create like a very public profile and a very like public life towards something that's like a little bit more private and a little bit more intimate with their friends. And I think when it comes to the security side of things, I don't really know if, because we've been so desensitized to this idea of these companies actually taking our data, if we're really ever going to really worry too much or care about it, at least as much as our parents did or even millennials. So I think we're just starting to see this trend where instead of actually really worrying about security, we're more just worried about how people are perceiving us, because that data piece, we already realize a lot of it has been used and taken up by these companies that we've been using since we've been little.
That's a huge shift, isn't it? If I look at that from an organizational standpoint, you know, within my organization, I might have a whole range of different generations. That particular perspective there is very different from one that I might have, or indeed, more importantly, one that I might have built my security policies and processes around, which really throws up this whole issue then of how do I adapt my organization to a new generation that's coming into the workplace? Because one thing is for sure, and that is that expecting a new generation to adapt to my organization is certainly not going to happen, right?
I think it really depends on a company by company basis and how they're laying out their processes to make sure that they're keeping in front of the best security trends. It really just comes down to education at the end of the day. I mean, Gen Z is really smart. You know, we've grown up with the internet, so we understand the trade-offs of what we're getting ourselves into. I think once things are explained and I think things are put into a way that's a little bit more, I guess, serious than just like, oh, hey, this company's using your data to sell to people or whatever, I think people are going to start thinking about it maybe a little bit more. But when it comes to like a company basis and hiring people and to build that, I think it just comes down to processes.
With her unconventional career path, Mahak embodies her generation's fresh approach to old problems. But as Steve noted, there can be risk in digital natives' familiarity and comfort with technology. Studies have shown that Gen Zers are more vulnerable to cybercrime and online scams than past generations, likely due to the reality that they have been raised in a digital culture that shares everything online. They've grown accustomed to the Internet of Things, and they even expect a certain level of digital surveillance. This means that their norms around security and privacy are very different from older generations, like Rich Guida, Steve, and me.
See, I remember 8-track tapes and, you know, back in the old days.
I remember getting VHS, like a video player, renting it from the
The movies.
Video store.
Absolutely.
It was a big deal.
It was. And you're right.
Rich has a lifetime of experience in the security industry and has witnessed countless advances in technology, especially the explosion in the volume of data and the way that data is shared. He evaluates new technologies with a degree of healthy skepticism, especially when it comes to information security.
I'm interested just to talk about your impression of the way in which technology has changed. You know, you've had a lot of experience in the use of it, both in the public sector with the Navy, for instance, more latterly in the private sector over a number of years. And so I'm intrigued to see how the different technology tools that you've used in your work have changed and perhaps some of the challenges you yourself have faced in adopting some of those and indeed, perhaps more importantly, getting people that you've worked with to adopt those.
Well, I guess I would start, first of all, I always like to establish what biases I might have. And my first bias is I look through everything with the prism of information security. And information security, of course, encapsulates the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of data. Now, the reason I say that right from the get-go is that naturally one takes a somewhat skeptical view, or skeptical is maybe too strong a word. One takes a view that is a bit hardened with respect to the uses of technology that a typical technology user might not adopt. So most users of technology, and I've seen this over the years, they adopt the technology, they, as what I like to call, whistle past the graveyard, which means basically something bad hasn't happened to them, and so therefore they're fat, dumb, and happy, and they enjoy it. It makes their life better, which is good. You know, it makes their lives better. But they don't think about what bad things can happen as a consequence of the use of that technology until the bad things happen. They may even hear news stories about bad things happening to others, but it doesn't relate to them unless it happens to a family member or a good friend or to them themselves. So as a security professional, what I try to do is enlighten people, whether they be lay people or people in enterprises, in companies, wherever it might be. I try to enlighten them as to the risks associated with the uses of technology. And those risks have become more and more profound over time. They become profound for several reasons. A lot of devices that used to operate in isolation, such as devices in power plants or in distribution centers or wherever they might be, they used to operate within their own environment, but not connected globally to the internet, not connected to an environment which is much more hostile. So those same devices, lacking the security protocols and mechanisms that are built into more modern equipment, are now being exposed, have been exposed to the internet. And the consequence of that is a tremendous growth in the vulnerability, spectrum, shall we say. And so I worry that people don't appreciate that. There's an old saying in security that you're very familiar with, which is you've got to build security, design security in at the time that a device or a protocol or a system is designed at that time. Don't try to tackle it later. Don't try to tack it on as an add-on feature. Because if you try to do it that way, you're going to miss some subtle elements that could have been eradicated during the design phase, but you're past that phase. Well, that doesn't exist today, okay? It doesn't exist with historical equipment and devices and protocols, and it also doesn't even exist with many modern pieces of equipment where the rush to get something to market overwhelms the need to do it right from a security standpoint. So if I can get something to market and it appeals to the masses, that's a success. I can make money at that. Later on, if it turns out that device is vulnerable to all sorts of security attacks, all sorts of threats, who cares? Because it's now in the hands of the consumer. I made my money. I move on. That is a very narrow kind of myopic view, but I've seen that happen over and over and over again. So to answer your question, the progression of technology that I've observed in my, having lived on the face of the planet for 150 years, the progression of technology that I've observed has been from very isolated types of activities where the need for security was not very profound and security could be employed in a very isolated kind of way and was effective in that respect, to very interconnected devices, Internet of Things, that sort of thing, where security is an afterthought. It was an afterthought in the first place. Now it's a double afterthought. And the consequence is we have a large spectrum of devices connected to the internet that actually don't belong being connected to the internet, but they are. And that is a very worrisome, a very fragile situation. That's where the security professional steps in and says, okay, I've heard what you've had to say. Let me now convert this into a risk or into a set of risks. You then go back and say, okay, I've converted your areas of concern into risks. And by the way, some of your areas of concern you don't really need to worry about because you're maybe unaware of mitigations or other things that we have in place, or you just may not be thinking right about something. Conversely, there are other things you're not worried about that you really should be worrying about. So it teases out this kind of disconnect between what they worry about versus what they should worry about. Once you've done that and you've constructed this set of risks from their areas of concern, then you can go come up with mitigations or proposed actions to deal with those risks. As an information security professional, I want there to be informed decisions. I'm not trying to impose my will upon, some other party. I want there to be an informed decision. Now, when I do it the way I've described it to you, almost never do the executives say, yeah, we've had second thoughts and we'll not fund this particular mitigation. Almost always they will say, yeah, okay, we get it. We were worried about that. This is a risk. We get it. We'll fund it. Maybe not quite as much money as one might like, but they'll fund some measures to deal with the issue. So that to me is the most important piece. You have to tie together what the executives are worried about to what you can then operationalize as an information security professional. That's the enlightenment. You're enlightening the execs. Once the execs are enlightened, getting the rest of the staff enlightened is an easier chore. I don't say it's easy, but it's an easier chore, because they take their marching orders from their leadership.
Yeah, and I suppose it's really in that element, I think, that the focus really needs to switch today, I would say. I think that perhaps what information security professionals have been relatively good at is coming up the curve on that one, understanding how to position it within the enterprise. The challenge that I see is that we're moving increasingly towards an environment where the end user is king. It is all about the smartphone. It is all about the tablet. I want to be able to use the same technology in my workplace as I do in my kitchen. And by the way, don't bother me with any of this security nonsense because it works, right? And it's not my responsibility anyway, because that's something that you, the enterprise, need to be concerned about. And so whilst I think we could probably give ourselves, I don't know, maybe a 6 or 7 out of 10 in terms of being able to reach out to the executive, where we now need to shift our attention is much more to the end user. And yes, you're right, they do take marching orders, but only to an extent. And it is, for me, this greying out of the kitchen and the workplace that is really going to cause us some problems. So tell me about perhaps how we can confront that. I mean, you know, we've talked before that certain ISF members have adopted approaches to doing that by perhaps looking at, you know, staying safe at home, keeping kids off the internet or off certain sites on the internet. But we need to go much further than that, don't we?
No, absolutely. Again, your comments are spot on. What I would observe is that the executive, the reason I was so focused on discerning the concerns of the executives first and translating them into risks is the very point that you just raised about, is there a clear understanding among the executives as to the risks associated with the bring your own device or use your own device mentality that, again, that you very artfully described. And oftentimes there is not, because the executives themselves want to use their own devices and do use their own devices, and they do so sometimes, I wouldn't say in a haphazard, but an unthoughtful way. So getting them to appreciate the risks associated with such activities is a very first important step. And that's why I use this, for lack of a better way to say it, a Socratic process of teasing out their concerns by asking questions, not telling them they should worry about it, asking them, are they worried about it? And then you will find, I've found when I hear that, some of them are very aware that there are a lot of risks, but there are big benefits, true. Others are less aware of the risks. And they become aware of the risks when you tease out that they tell you, I'm not really worried about that. Should I be? And then you explain, well, yeah, here's why you probably should be. Okay. But that kind of Socratic engagement is so much different than telling them you should be worried about X without even having heard from them first what it is that's on top of mind. Now, to your question, once you've gotten that kind of zeitgeist, okay, the kind of mindset that says, you know, maybe this is something we should be worried about, the answer then to the question you raised isn't that we stop using bring your own devices, because that's not going to happen. Clearly, there will continue to be widespread use of such devices. But what it means is, and what I've done with many clients is, I lay out, all right, if this is a big risk, which we believe it to be, and people are going to do it, which we know they will, okay, and we don't want to stop them because that would be a big impact on the company, then what are the technical measures that we can put in place that are reasonably transparent to the users, that won't interfere with them getting their jobs done, and yet will protect our enterprise, our resources, our network, you know, our servers, et cetera.
And these sorts of things are quite easy to do. I mean, that's the beauty of them, isn't it? And I think that you make a very valid point that transparency is so very important. You know, if people can understand why we're doing certain things and they can understand, as you rightly point out, the process that they can go through, then to have things changed, then we're partway there. Just moving on slightly, we're beginning to talk about some emerging technologies that are out there, some of the ways in which technology is changing people's lives. Do you believe we're safer? Are we more secure because of the way in which technology is changing? And of course, because of the increased sophistication, I guess, of the layperson or the person using that technology. Is that making us more secure, do you think, or is it having the opposite kind of effect?
Sadly, I think it's the opposite. And this is not to denigrate or to demean the many very noble efforts of a lot of vendors to build in security into their products. The trouble is what I alluded to earlier. Most products, the impetus is to bring things to market quickly, particularly in the IoT space, the Internet of Things space. And bringing things to market quickly almost always denigrates security. You connect these things to the internet, to these networks, to the internet, and suddenly you have the ability to control devices that are running, power plants, water treatment plants, et cetera, and can destroy the physical hardware, can basically bring networks, bring grids crashing down. So my concern there is, honestly, that a lot of the devices that are being built into those environments, which are aimed at like the smart grid. Every time I see a commercial on the smart grid, I apologize, but I almost want to just hold my nose. You know, the smart grid is going to make things more energy efficient, all that. Yes, it's a good thing, except for the fact that it's opening up massive vulnerabilities that could easily be exploited by not just nation states that want to do harm to the United States, but even by criminals who may want to hold a grid hostage, until they are paid couple million dollars. So criminal organizations, the nature of the threat changes when these things get connected to the internet. So my point in saying all that is just that I think that as a whole, society as a whole is getting less secure, not more secure, as we do all these things. Now, do I think that means that we're headed to Armageddon or to a situation where, you know, where we shouldn't be doing that stuff? No. I think what it means is there has to be, and this is a bad word these days, but there needs to be appropriate government regulation of devices that are providing public services. Now, what about devices owned by individuals? Here, the calculus is a bit different. I would agree with you, certainly, that I think that some of the devices that have more recently been brought to market do appear to have much better security built into them than older devices do. The trouble that I see is that these devices, first of all, they're not yet ubiquitous. We still have a lot of older devices in the environment which are pretty profoundly corrupted or corruptible. And the newer devices have only been in the marketplace for brief periods. It has not yet been established just how secure they really are. Those I continue to be extremely worried about. The Nest thermometer, there was on Amazon, there was a coffee maker where you could buy it that, and it would connect to the internet so you could control it over the internet. This is a coffee pot that has to connect to the internet. So that is an example of an IoT device that I just ask myself, why? Well, because it's jazzy and you can make a few extra dollars selling it. Yeah, at the same time, you now create an opportunity for a botnet to go absorb it. So it's just that kind of mindlessness that worries me. Let me describe it this way. I have two competing products. One team plows ahead, ignores security, doesn't worry about encrypting contents, encrypting transmission, doesn't worry about any of that, just plows ahead, produces the product, you know, a year later, okay? The other team wants to produce the same product, and they are thinking about, we better encrypt stuff early on, we better build in strong authentication protocols, better build in strong controls for managing privileges, better do all those things. And they might take an extra couple of weeks, an extra month, because they have these additional requirements imposed on them that were not imposed on the other team. If I'm a leader and I don't know much about security, I don't want to know much about security, I don't care about it that much because most of my customers are, may even be off put by having to put in, you know, a longer password instead of just typing in, you know, my mother's name, something like that. Oftentimes, sadly, they go with the first team, they'll go with the other team. To them, the convenience of use and the time to market is more important than anything else. And then later, when a problem does emerge, oh, okay, we'll fix it. Mm-hmm. Meantime, all the customers have bought this product, they've deployed it, they've used it, and now they're stuck to some degree with the product, and they have to now await the fix. I'll give you an example. This is not to pick on any company, but Apple. You may remember there was a celebrity whose account was hacked. Mm-hmm. I think it was iTunes or something. Account was hacked. And it turns out the reason it was hacked was because the account did not have any limit on the number of failed attempts. You could try to log in unlimited number of times. And that was portrayed as a feature. You'll never get locked out of your account, right? Mm-hmm. Well, when the celebrity got hacked, Apple changed their tune, so to speak. And they put in, I think it was a limit of five or 10 attempts before a lockout occurred for a certain period of time. That was a good example of a security requirement that should have been there from the beginning, but was not, because they decided it wasn't important. I think that the education of the buyer is something that is achievable, but it will take time. I use as an analogy automobiles. You know, 50 years ago, when I first started driving, okay, they were pretty darn unsafe. They didn't have seat belts. They didn't have any of that stuff. Certainly no airbags, you know, any of the above. My automobiles now are much safer. They have the airbags. They've got collision avoidance. They've got all that technology built in. And as a consumer, I know that I, my sons, a lot of people I know do ask about the IIHS ratings or the NHTSA ratings, you know, on safety for the vehicles. I want to buy a vehicle that's safe, okay? And then I'll pick color and other things, but safety and reliability are the two most important things. Now, granted, I'm an engineer, but that nonetheless is filtered into kind of the zeitgeist of people's thinking. I like to think that that same kind of way of thinking will ultimately prevail with a lot of these devices, but it's going to take longer because you can do safety ratings on automobiles, collision tests and things like that. They're much more easily performed than a lot of security tests, okay? Security is a much more complicated beast than collision tests, but nonetheless, you can do that. So that is a hopeful kind of signal that might, you know, might drive us in the right direction, so to speak.
An interesting and valuable conclusion there from Rich Guida, and one that directly answers Mahak Vora's observation that Gen Zers are willing to trade aspects of privacy and security for access to information or tools online. Will end users of any generation proceed with more caution when there are security tests? With results that inform our decisions responding to the risk of such technologies? What I think we can take away from these two viewpoints is that with Gen Z's arrival in our workplaces, they bring ambition, creativity, and a willingness to find new ways of approaching old problems that will doubtless be a major benefit to their enterprises. Members of Gen Z also bring the perspective of a new generation of consumers. Clearly, security teams can benefit from both the experience and wisdom of age and the creativity and fresh perspective of youth. The most successful organizations will be those that best blend team members of all ages, and this will require receptivity and education for workers of all ages. Savvy organizations also need to adapt to Gen Z's norms and attitudes around security and privacy. They will need to cater their training and awareness materials to the ambivalence about technology that this generation holds. And they need to pay close attention to Gen Z's embrace of social media and the impact of their lifelong immersion in digital technology. Thank you to both Rich Guida and Mahak Vora for participating in today's episode. Next week, Steve is in conversation with Matthew Doan, Senior Manager at BCG Plantinion and Cybersecurity Policy Fellow at New America. Steve and Matthew will talk about growing a skill set, finding purpose at work, and what the workforce of the future might look like. Here's a preview from that conversation.
Say if you've got 100 technical experts, say in a cybersecurity organization, and they've got every certification you could ever want. Just maybe 5 or 10 of those people that would even want to elevate into a leadership position to want to develop their soft skills, because many people are very content at just staying strong in their technical discipline. And we need those people. We need the distinguished architects, the level 3 threat hunter, the malware reverse engineer. We need all of those things. But the small set of people that choose to raise their hand and say, I want to be something bigger, I want to lead, those are the people that I think will find the bravery. And then we need to support those very few people to help their evolution.
We look forward to bringing you the full interview. In the meantime, we invite you to tune into our catalog of video and podcast episodes, all of which you can find at securityforum.org. We'd love for you to follow the audio feed wherever you get your podcasts, and we'd be very grateful if you'd recommend us. Growing our subscriber numbers helps us reach new audiences and helps us continue to bring you these timely discussions. Join in the conversation on our LinkedIn page by searching CEO Steve Durbin or Security Forum. You can also directly download from ISF's website the research, practical tools, and guidance that we discuss in conversations like these. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert. Music by Alexander Filipiak. Associate producer Katie Flood. Mix and master by Brian Barney. Thanks for listening.